The Minds in Motion podcast from Dementia Researcher, in association with the NIHR Applied Research Collaborations and Alzheimer's Society, showcasing exciting new research and the work of the DEMCOM fellows.
Hello, and welcome to the fourth episode of the Minds in Motion podcast from Dementia Researcher. Today, discussing the effectiveness and accessibility of singing and dancing intervention services for people living with dementia and the incredible work of Dr. Megan Polden. Hello, I'm Dr. Chris Poyner. I'm a Dementia Communities of Practice Research Fellow in the West Midlands NIHR Applied Research Collaboration working at the University of Birmingham. In the last show, we heard about my research, and today it's my turn to sit alongside my amazing co-host, Trevor Salomon, and take the reins.
Thanks very much, Chris. Hello, I'm Trevor Salomon. I'm an Alzheimer's Society volunteer and Vice Chair of the European Dementia Carers Working Group. My passion and involvement is driven through the time I've spent as a full-time carer for my wife Yvonne, who was diagnosed with young-onset Alzheimer's disease. The diagnosis actually came in 2013 when she was 57. I managed to care for her at home until 2019 when her double incontinence and my fatigue just meant we needed professional care. So she's been living in a care home for the last 5 years and very well looked after. Through this podcast series, we've been hearing about some of the incredible research being delivered as part of the DEMCOM Fellowship Programme. If you're listening for the first time, this is a great three-year partnership between the NIHR Applied Research Collaborations and Alzheimer's Society, and it promises to deliver the next generation social science research leaders, and furthermore, is exploring lots of research areas that are often overlooked. So, let's get on with the show.
Hi, Megan. Could I start by asking you to introduce yourself?
Thank you very much for having me. So my name is Megan, and I am a research fellow at the University of Liverpool. I'm also affiliated with Lancaster University as well. So I am part of the DEMCOM Dementia Fellowship cohort, and my current research is looking at singing and dancing interventions and their impact on people living with dementia and their carers.
And thanks, Megan. And can you tell us about your current research?
Yes. So the research project that I'm working on currently, I've got the pleasure of working with two local charities. So the Brain Charity, which is Liverpool based, and another charity called Lyrics and Lunch, which deliver singing and dancing interventions for people living with dementia and their carers. And they're a mix between whether they're delivered within the community for people living still within the community, or whether in care homes and day centres and things like that as well. So what we wanted to do is look at the impact of these services for both people living with dementia and carers. So a lot of previous research has really focused on the impacts that singing interventions and dancing interventions can have specifically for people with dementia, which is really important and something we want to capture in our research. But what we also want to capture is the impacts that they can have on people's carers and family and relatives as well when they attend the sessions with them. And then another thing specifically that we want to look at within this research is looking at any barriers and facilitators that people encounter when trying to access these sort of support services as well, and kind of ways that they can be potentially adapted to make them as accessible and wide-reaching as possible.
I was very interested in one aspect of this. My wife in particular loved singing, and she used to go to singing for the memory and dancing to some extent too. But I wonder if any of your research has covered how you get people to want to attend when, generally speaking, they just don't. My father, for example, had Alzheimer's. My mother could not get him to go to a day centre or any activities at all.
Yeah. So that is can be quite a tricky thing in terms of being able to try and engage people and get them to want to engage with these type of support services that are on offer. I think it's trying to encourage people to have like a bit of an open mind with it. And I know there's been a few people that when I've seen the sessions be done in kind of care homes and day centres, there might be a couple of people that are initially a bit unsure and a bit wanting to kind of take a step back. They might not be in like kind of the initial group, and they might just sit back and kind of engage in their own way. But you might find that after a little while, they're kind of up dancing as well, or they're really engaging with the singers and things like that. And they've actually surprised themselves in terms of what they're wanting to engage with and what enjoyment and things that they can get out of those sessions. So I think it's definitely listening to the person in terms of what they're wanting to engage with, but trying to encourage people to have a bit of an open mind in terms of what benefit they might be able to get out of these support services.
I was really interested in the fact that you've got loads of different sites for this research. So there's care home work, community work as well. I was just wondering whether there was any kind of key differences that you've noticed so far in the work that's going on in the care homes compared to the work that's happening out in the community.
I definitely think there's different benefits from the sessions that you can get depending on. And that's something that we're going to look at in the research, kind of if we're seeing different benefits for people living in the community, whereas people living in care homes and kind of engaging with day centres. And that's definitely starting to emerge in terms of someone living in the community, we're looking at doing measures of like loneliness and social isolation. And for them, being able to grow that social network by engaging in community groups, maybe have more of an impact for people living in the community, but for people in care homes, it might be other factors such as maybe like improvements in cognition. It might be reduced feelings of agitation and kind of improvements in mood and things like that. So I definitely think we potentially might see some differences in terms of like the different impacts that these groups have at different stages of people's dementia journeys.
My personal observation of the difference is that when my wife attended sessions in the community, she was very much seen as a participant. In fact, that was the whole purpose of attending. Now she's in a care home. I really feel that when people come along to lead these sessions, they're more of a performer and less recognizing the need to have the residents participate. I mean, sometimes they do, but often they don't. And I think that's my obvious difference that I've spotted. I don't know if it's the same for you.
So one of the things that that the session leaders and the people who run these sessions are absolutely fantastic at finding ways, and the Brain Charity and both Lyrics and Lunch as well have developed such fantastic interventions that are just really great at managing to engage people of all kind of dementia stages. And they kind of use like props and different engagement tools like that. So for example, some of the sessions will use kind of like the inflatable ball that they'll pass around and get people to kind of, because it's kind of engaging that type of movement and things in it, get people to throw things. It helps people learn people's names and kind of a bit of an icebreaker. And then they'll also use things like kind of props for scarves and kind of little instruments and things like that. And sometimes, especially like for the dance sessions, it can be quite daunting they kind of will guide people through movements. But for some people, that's maybe a bit too difficult for them to engage with. But a lot of the time, if you give them a scarf or you give people an instrument, the first instinct is to kind of move them around or shake them or do something with it because they're given that, using those different methods to be able to engage people. And then also just kind of like the session leaders are just fantastic in terms of like if somebody maybe is engaging in their own way in terms of maybe not following all the dance moves or maybe not actively singing along, but they're just kind of sitting back and listening. It's kind of all about having like eye contact with them and going over to approach them and get engagement in different ways.
Yeah, that's really interesting, Megan. I was really wondering about, because it seems to me there's two kind of things going on here. You've got the benefits, potential benefits to the music itself and engaging with music, and then the peer support and interaction and attendance at these sessions. And I was just wondering whether you're separating out those two, I guess, variables, or whether you're just judging it more kind of holistically.
Currently at the minute, we're not able to kind of do a like randomized control trial. We're able to kind of completely separate like the social elements of them. Currently, it's something we'd like to be able to kind of tease apart the differences and kind of like the benefits of specifically doing a singing or dancing intervention, and then trying to discern from all the social aspects and things that come along with it. But specifically for these two charities and the intervention that they've developed, for them, the social aspect is a really key integral element of it. So, for example, with the Brain Charity, they do a bit of socialising with the sessions to begin before they begin, and then they'll do their singing or dancing intervention. And then they'll also hang around and interact with the residents and people who attend the sessions for like a little bit afterwards as well, to kind of build up that type of rapport. And then with Lyrics and Lunch, the format of their sessions is that they have a hour singing and then an hour sociable lunch, so that social element particularly for these interventions is a really integral part. So it's something we'd like to do in the future in terms of being able to tease apart the benefits and where they're coming from the two different locations. But specifically in our research at the minute, it's not something we're able to do, unfortunately.
Yeah, no worries. And then the other thing I was wondering about was the kind of therapeutic benefit of the sessions for the relationships in care homes between the staff and the residents, and also any potential for these sessions, especially the ones that are engaging the people with dementia and getting them to use instruments in certain ways, even if it's quite rudimentary, to challenge some of the notions around people with dementia, the stigma, and their ability to learn new things, for example.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. So I'll answer the first bit first about kind of the relationships with care staff and people with dementia. So yeah, so that's a really, really nice thing that we've seen that, and I've been able to witness from the project, and that we're trying to capture as well in terms of qualitative interviews with them, the care staff and care facilitators. And it's come up quite a lot of the time that it has kind of impacted how they deliver their care, having experienced the intervention, and that they've had those kind of bonding moments with residents and people living with dementia, and they've found it really beneficial, and that it's impacted their day-to-day kind of how they give care. And they've said back that, you know, they've got these, they kind of use the same songs, and they'll be singing the songs to people, and they'll be able to respond to that and things like that. And then they've also just kind of fed back in terms of they've just had a lot more music just generally in kind of like the care home and around the care home, and they've been utilizing that a lot more because they've really seen the benefit that it's had to people. And then it's been really lovely to see as well how it's kind of, especially with the dancing sessions and the singing sessions, there's been a lot of times where the care staff might not realize that they've come from like a dance background. You put some music on and they'll just get up and they'll be dancing with the care staff and maybe other residents and the session leaders, and you can see their reactions that they just did not know that you could clearly see that they maybe had a dance background from how they're moving. And it's just lovely to see that, them kind of witness that in learning something new about that person.
When I took my wife to singing for the memory sessions, because she had to be accompanied by somebody, that was the rule, she was always in very happy and in a great mood immediately afterwards. And the same applied to the dance sessions she went to at a day centre, which I didn't attend. But half an hour later, she had no recollection of either. And I often wondered, you know, what is the science behind all of this? And why do cognitive functions and emotional well-being seem so improved immediately after a session?
And that's a really good question. So I think there's a lot of science behind it in terms of how music can kind of be cognitively stimulating for people. When you're singing, it engages different parts of the brain from just plain speech and things like that. And that can have a lot of cognitive benefits for everybody. And then in terms of the different kind of benefits that you can have, but maybe with mood that might appear short-lived, I think that's one of the things we're wanting to try and discern, is kind of how long-lived those impacts are from the sessions. And that can be really difficult to determine and capture in research. But I think they can potentially be long-lasting in terms of, like, they might not have an improvement on your mood straight away, but you can kind of, like, that reflects in maybe how agitated people are throughout the day and things like that. I do think the benefits can be more wide-reaching, especially when you look at kind of like the social connections and things like that that develop from going to these sessions as well. So
I'm a lousy dancer, so I couldn't help with anything thereafter with those sessions. But for the singing, for the memory sessions, then I would help my wife sing those songs for as long as I could remember them after the session. And you know, she did join in and she did smile. And that definitely worked. But if I didn't do that, it was just all gone in a flash, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess as well, that's a really good point to make as well, in terms of maybe encouraging friends and relatives and carers at home to kind of keep doing those songs for longer, to be able to make them last longer. I think that's a good point.
Thanks, guys. So, Megan, I was wondering about the usefulness of, or the effectiveness of, these interventions for people living with quite advanced or end-of-life dementia, or receiving end-of-life care. And obviously, we're talking about care homes again. That's an area that I'm particularly interested in. So I was just wondering whether in the care homes, the staff there are able, have the facilities to, or the desire to help residents get into these sessions who may be really struggling with their health.
And it's a really good point. And I think there's a lot of research that's been done that's looked at different types of music interventions and which ones are maybe most appropriate at different stages of people's dementia journey. And a lot of the research has kind of indicated that more music listening and kind of more advanced dementia stages can be more beneficial and have more benefits in that way. With the singing and things, they might get to the point where they struggle to kind of actively engage with that type of intervention. I do think there is specific stages where it may be different types of music intervention, so more kind of passive music listening might be more beneficial.
In my wife's care home, and this is really a response to Chris, but Megan's view would be interesting too, they publish every week a list of activities. And when the family members receive those lists, they will often call into the care home and say, please make sure that my loved one attends this because I know they will enjoy it. So sometimes I think a gentle push needs to come from family members too.
So you've touched on this a bit already, Megan, but I just wanted to give you the opportunity to highlight, you know, what your research is building upon in terms of what the evidence base that already exists. Is there anything specifically that's inspired the project or what you'd like to build upon?
As I was mentioning previously, in terms of being able to catch up kind of the impact that these interventions have on carers and family members and people living with dementia is a really important factor for this specific research. And then a lot of previous research has specifically focused on the singing intervention itself and kind of more of the cognitive benefits of the singing. Like, there's been a large amount of research that's focused on kind of how does this impact people's cognition. And that's really important to be able to capture, but a lot less of the research is focused on the social element, and that's specifically something that we really wanted to expand the research on with these looking at these interventions.
How do you measure the effectiveness of interventions then, Megan?
That in itself is difficult to do. So we are using a mixed methods model for our interventions. So each service is kind of run slightly different. So the Brain Charity intervention they offer theirs is a 12-week intervention, and they'll get people will experience a session every week. And for that particular method, we're doing like assessments prior to when they started and assessments after on a range of different standardized questionnaire measures. And then we're also for Lyrics and Lunch, because if people are already actively attending it, they tend to have a bit of a break during the summer. So we're kind of doing a bit of seeing how people are on these standardized assessments in terms of mood, well-being, quality of life. And then we're comparing that to when they have been attending it as versus when they've not been attending it. And then we're also looking at it from a qualitative aspect as well, getting people's opinions on the impact that it has on their lives from people with dementia and their carers, and then also kind of the session leaders and kind of care staff and session facilitators that help facilitate these. So trying to see it from as many different angles to be able to capture the impact that it has by using a range of methods, really.
Uh-huh. And are you, to what extent are you under more pressure than ever to measure? I'm thinking in the context of funding now, because funding is ever more challenging. And in order to get money out, you need to be able to prove something, I guess. So is this something that you're helping, for example, care homes or groups to deal with?
So in terms of helping them to get funding, is that what you meant?
Yes, specifically in that context.
So we are, that is one of the reasons why we wanted to work with some of the charities that have already established these types of interventions, because they are kind of standalone charities and they do need their own funding to be able to continue to run these sessions and to be able to grow to sessions so they can help more people. So that is something that we're hoping that our research, if it does show an impact on their services, will be able to help them improving their impact when they go for kind of more funding applications to be able to support and to maintain the kind of interventions and stuff that they've established within the communities.
So Megan, just to focus on the community work for a minute, because we've talked a lot about the care home stuff. I was just wondering about the settings that the interventions take place in and about any challenges that you've had with those settings or whether you've kind of feel there's any barriers in place that may be preventing people from attending in the environment, for example?
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. So the community-based sessions that are predominantly based in Lancaster area, so it is more of a rural area. So when we have been looking at kind of barriers and things like that, that travel and access to those venues have come up as a barrier for people attending them. And I think that's one of the reasons why the charity, in particular Lyrics and Lunch, is trying to get as many possible groups that they can get established as much as they can, so to be able to make it as easy as possible for these people to attend those sessions. So Lyrics and Lunch, the church-based charity as well, so they'll tend to use community halls and church halls from there. So a lot of the times they are quite nicely situated within communities, so it's just trying to be able for them to get more groups and more churches involved and things like that, so that they can deliver more, they can be more easily accessible for people.
Yeah, because I think it's probably quite a key thing. I know from some of my research previously, I know this isn't about me, but I did some work on this in Salford Uni, and we had a place on site where the music interventions would take place. And then one time they said we couldn't do it in there, we had to move it to a different room, and it was really detrimental to the people with dementia. So I was just wondering if you have any reflections on, I guess, the importance of space for these things to be successful.
Yeah, definitely. I think having a kind of like a nice open space where people can get familiar with it, and having that kind of space being maintained throughout the whole of the intervention or for as long as possible, I think is really important. Because like you say, people getting familiar with this space and getting comfortable in that place is really important for them to be able to engage with those type of sessions and feel comfortable in that environment as well. So yeah, I do think that's a really important point.
Yeah, and I think familiarity becomes another aspect. I first started taking my wife to a Singing for the Brain session, which was 40-minute journey away. And eventually I found a group that was 10 minutes away. So it was much more convenient for me, but it took my wife a while to settle into that group because she wasn't familiar with the environment.
And then just finally on kind of barriers, I wanted to ask about, I guess, the cultural nature of these sessions. How would you describe the cultural nature of these sessions? And do you think that whatever that is may cause some issues in terms of engagement with people from more diverse communities and backgrounds?
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. So the sessions do try and incorporate kind of like a bit of an individualized element for people. So in terms of, they will have kind of set songs that they'll tend to do, and they're quite popular songs that people will tend to know. And then they will also kind of take requests from people, kind of being able to tailor it to their specific music tastes and things like that. But yeah, I would agree. The sessions as they are currently predominantly tailored towards people from kind of a white British background. And yeah, I definitely think having services like this that are adapted to different cultural backgrounds is really, really important, because I think even maybe just adding a few songs is not quite enough to kind of capture the range of different types of music that people experience and people kind of know from their youth. And so I do think kind of having adapted versions of these for people from different cultures is really important to be able to get more people to engage with them.
And I guess in a multicultural society where we've had immigration flows over the years, that becomes an imperative, because the songs that people remember that are deep in their memory will be from their childhood in another country potentially.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
In terms of your work, Megan, have you got any really outstanding case studies that you could share with our listeners and viewers?
Yeah, so it's been, I think for me in particular, it's been an absolute pleasure to be able to go to all these sessions and attend them and see the impact they have on people. We've had one particular couple who came and engaged with the sessions, and they were doing one of the dance sessions, and they'd only just recently entered a assisted living facility. And it was lovely to kind of see how the impact it kind of had on their relationship, and how seeing them being able to do something that they enjoyed together. And that was also one of the first community groups that they'd started to engage with. They'd also had some problems with trying to convince the person with dementia to want to go to like and engage with day centres. And after that 12-week intervention, that was something that they were talking about how much they were going to miss this particular dance session, but how they were then had the confidence to be able to seek out those other interventions and art groups and different things that were going on in the community, and potentially looking at trying a day centre as well. So kind of seeing the impact in that sense and hearing their experience and how it's kind of given them that confidence to be able to try these new activities and engage with those things. And that was really nice to see.
The question we'd love to ask you is, where do you see your research heading? What's the next phase of your research?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I know we've talked about some of the difficulties that we can have in terms of being able to capture like the impact of these sessions. And one of the things that I'd like to do going forward is in the moment analysis and kind of video analysis of kind of comparing people's behavior for maybe an hour before the activity and then how much engagement they have during the activity as well. We kind of maybe capture those shorter term benefits that we've not been able to necessarily capture in our current research. So I would like to look at kind of incorporating those methods a little bit more. And then the point that Chris is making as well in terms of being able to make some of these sessions a bit more culturally adapted culturally to different types of people to be able to make them more wide reaching. That's definitely something that I'd like to look into doing in the future as well.
Right. Well, in the next part of the podcast, we've got some quick fire career questions for you that we hope will help others thinking about working in the field. And we'd like you to share some of what you've learned from across your career and through the DEMCOM program.
So, Megan, are you ready? Remember, short answers only. Okay. The first question is, was there a pivotal moment or influence that led you to specifically choose dementia research as your field of study?
So when I was doing my A-levels during the summer holidays, I did some voluntary work in a care home. And that was kind of one of the first proper experiences I'd had with working with people with dementia. And that really just made me fascinated by the condition and just like seeing the impact it had on people living with dementia and their carers as well. And it just, since then, I really wandered with those people. And ever since then, I was just like wanted to do research to help them.
Thanks. And if you think about others who might follow you, what skills do you consider essential for anybody aspiring to a career in dementia research?
I think having really good communication skills and being a good listener as well. I think all research projects should be fed from people living with dementia and their carers and relatives and things like that. And I think it's integral to be able to listen to what people are needing to be able, as a first point of call, before you even think of how to develop research, and kind of having that engagement with people within the community of what they're needing. So I think having really good listening skills and good communication skills to reach out.
Fantastic. And Megan, how do you maintain a healthy life balance in the context of the challenges of academia?
I do try. I think I'd be lying if I said that I got perfect every time. I feel actually having a dog helps because she has amazingly strict schedule. And come 6 o'clock, whether my laptop's closed or not, she is hassling me to take her out for a walk. So it helps me switch off a little bit in that sense. But I think it is really challenging. It is, but I think when you love what you're doing so much, it doesn't seem quite as bad. But yeah,
most people who have dogs seem to tell me that definitely imposes an exercise discipline, which otherwise they may not have. Yeah, unfortunately, I've only got fish in a fish pond and they don't give me any of that at all. What's the most important thing you think you've learned so far from the fellowship programme, Megan?
Yeah, that's a good question. One of the things that I've learned that's been really great, kind of how different and how diverse the cohort is in terms of how they've managed to get into the fellowship and how and where they're at, there how they've kind of gone to get to that place. So I think previously when I was studying, I always thought there was only really one way to get into research. And I think doing this fellowship and meeting all these different people from all these different backgrounds and has really showed how there's so many different ways that you can get into research and that you can get into research at any different point in your career as well. So I think that's been really interesting to see.
And what advice would you give to anyone just finishing their PhD and undecided on what to do next?
It's a good question. I would say persevere. I think have good perseverance. I think in research and academia as well, there's a lot of rejection and you can feel like you're having a lot of setbacks and it can be quite challenging to be able to get to where you're hoping to get to. And I think just persevere with it. And if it's a research area that you really, really love, just keep persevering with it. And even if it's not the right time for that particular project and that application maybe doesn't get accepted at that particular time, you know, keep it. It's still potentially a really good idea and maybe the time is just not right. So I think it's just that perseverance to kind of keep trying to do what it is that you're interested in.
I'm sure that's very sound advice. Right, we're coming up to the final questions, and these are a little bit different. If you could time travel to any period in history, when would you go to share your knowledge about dementia and why?
A really good question. I think to be able to go back as far as possible where people would be willing to kind of accept the research and actually want to kind of engage with it. And I think, I think it's a tricky one in terms of gauging exactly when that would be. But I guess I'm giving a bit of a cop-out answer. I think particularly for the singing and dancing, maybe around like the 60s, because I definitely think at that time, like singing and dancing was definitely more integral to people and they kind of like engaged it a bit more. So I think trying to keep that going, maybe to be able to explain the benefits at that stage and also kind of explain to kind of people what dementia is earlier, just at any point would be beneficial.
I don't know what Chris thinks about that response, but I think I'd also want to go back to the 60s because I remember as a kid being frightened when I heard parents and others saying, oh, you know, granny's gone doolally or senile, because nobody really understood what was happening to them. If we could have understood differently that it was a disease and it wasn't their fault rather than something that would just happen to older people, I think I would have been less scared about going into care homes. But I was, as a child, really quite scared of care homes. As many children were.
Yeah. I think that's a really good point. Sorry, I'm going off a little bit on a tangent, but I think that's one of the areas that I really find interesting is kind of intergenerational research. And I think being able to kind of educate children on what dementia is and removing that stigma is also really important.
So next question, if you could collaborate on your dementia research with any fictional character, who would it be? How do you think they would contribute?
Found this one really tricky. I wasn't sure the best avenue to go on this one. But I was thinking like someone like Iron Man, because he's like, as we saw when I was trying to set my mic up for this, I'm not that tech savvy. So if I could have someone that could be really tech savvy, I feel like that would complement my lack of skills in the technology department. And he also might have some spare like funding lying around as well. So.
Yeah. That's critical, absolutely.
That wasn't an answer I was expecting.
Thought I'd mix it up a bit.
Well, thank you for that. I'm afraid that's all we have time for today. If you want to learn more about this topic or the DEMCOM programme, visit the Dementia Research website, where you will find a full transcript, Megan's biography, and very much more. Now, I would like to thank our incredible guest, Dr. Megan Polden. I'm Trevor Salomon.
And I'm Chris Poyner. And you've been listening to the Dementia Researcher podcast.
You've been listening to the Minds in Motion podcast from Dementia Researcher, in association with the NIHR Applied Research Collaborations and Alzheimer's Society. To learn more about the DEMCOM programme and to get all the support you need, visit dementiaresearcher.nihr.ac.uk. And don't forget to like and subscribe.